Welcome to the Paid in Full podcast. I'm Devin Fadul, and in this show, I sit down with creators of all stripes who have decided to follow their passion and carve out a unique path to success. My goal is to dive into their stories, learn about their philosophies, and share their hard-earned wisdom. Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Paid in Full podcast. I apologize for the long wait, but I do think today's guest will more than make up for it. I had the distinct honor of chatting with the profound, the prolific, the profane, Jared Dillian, who, in addition to writing the daily DirtNap newsletter, has published 4 books and counting. Street Freak, All the Evil of This World, Those Bastards, and most recently, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. Pound for pound, Jared is easily one of the most insightful writers out there, with life lessons on everything from depression to friendship, and of course, personal finance. All right, we cover a lot in this episode, so let's just get to it. Here's my conversation with Jared Dillian. Jared, good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good to see you. Good to finally meet you. I feel like I've been immersed in your work for the better part of the last 12 months, like effectively nonstop. I don't remember exactly how, but I found your newsletter and then dove into Those Bastards, the book, and then recently your novel. It was amazing. Really, really enjoyed it. Immediately just dove into Street Freak right after. I'm only about halfway through that, but really enjoying that as well. And so I'm thinking, like, I started my career. I graduated undergrad in 2007. I got a glimpse for about, I don't know, maybe 6 to 9 months of what the industry kind of looked like pre-2008. But to me, there was still a pretty clear divide between, you know, pre-2008 and post-2008. But tell me, am I wrong about that?
No, I mean, the whole industry changed after the financial crisis. I would say from the mid-90s to 2008 was kind of like that, you know, those were the golden years. It was really the Wild West, and it was huge amounts of fun. And, you know, industries kind of go in and out of favor over time. Like back in the 90s and 2000s, everyone wanted to be in banking, and then they wanted to be in hedge funds, and now they want to be in private equity. And 5 years from now, it'll be something else. But I consider myself to be very lucky to have been working on Wall Street during that time, which was its wildest and most exciting time. And Lehman Brothers, I think, on Wall Street was even more unique because of its culture. Like, it was so entrepreneurial that anyone anywhere in the firm could take a risk, put on a trade, and if it didn't work out, there were really no consequences. They would just say, okay, try again. You know, I was running about $250 million of a prop book that I started in about 2006. I never asked anyone's permission. I just opened an account and started trading. And that's what it was like.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm like halfway through Street Freak, and already, you know, you're making decisions. There's other guys that are making decisions, and I'm like blown away about essentially just the lack of bureaucracy in the firm. And yeah. I keep saying, like, is he glossing over details? Is he outright lying? Cause I just, it's unbelievable. Cause I, you know, I came up effectively post 2008, and yeah. I don't have too many stories pre 2008. All I can say is that, you know, we're a bunch of 22-year-olds with corporate credit cards, just blowing it out. And then 2008 comes and it's all gone. I guess what I'm trying to say is I feel like I missed the boat, man, because it's been all buttoned up since then.
Yeah.
So just reading your books, both All the Evil of This World and Street Freak, just has me longing for some existence that I kind of never had.
Yeah. How old are you?
38, about to be 39.
I'm turning 50 tomorrow.
Well, happy early birthday. So,
yeah.
What are you doing for celebration?
Going out to dinner at my favorite place. My wife's got something up her sleeve. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure it's going to be good.
Down in Myrtle, right?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, you moved down there because your wife teaches at the university.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
What do you think about it? Do you like Myrtle?
Yeah. I mean, Myrtle Beach proper is not that great. It's gotten better over the years. You know, I've been here for 14 years and it's come up a lot. I live south. I live in Pawleys Island, which is kind of the high rent district. Some great restaurants down there. It's really nice. It's really quiet. And I'm building a house there. It's going to be done in a couple of months. So I love it. Like I said, I moved here in 2010 and I'm never leaving. Like, we're staying here forever.
Do you miss New York at all?
I go up a lot. I go to New York a lot on business and to go on TV and stuff. So I'm there 5 or 6 times a year anyway. So I get my fill, you know.
So let's get back to writing. I don't know. You've read some of my stuff. I have somewhat of a style, but I'm not, by no means am I a writer. So I'm looking for some sort of like maybe kick in the ass to do it on a daily basis. Any tips?
You already know the answer. Like, my writing has changed over the years. You know, I've been writing at a minimum 1,500 words a day, at a maximum about 5,000 every day for the last 20 years. Okay. And my writing has changed over time. Like, in the beginning, it was sort of this fluid intelligence. It was very creative and very artistic. And it's gotten more utilitarian over time. I've gotten better at some things. I've gotten better at persuasive writing, making an argument. I would say that my artistry has probably decreased a little bit. You know, one thing you haven't seen is for the last year, year and a half, I've been writing short stories. And I have a short story collection coming out in November. It's going to be called Night Moves. So I have 16 short stories. I've been trying to get these published in the literary magazines. I've only gotten one published. I've had a couple of other close calls. I don't know what you know about the literary business right now, but it's difficult for somebody like me to get published. So I'm just going the self-publishing route for the book, and it's going to be awesome. People are going to love the stories. So, but for you, like, I've read your writing. Don't sell yourself short. You're fantastic. You're really, really good. You know, and in particular, like, that review you wrote of Those Bastards was so good. Like, that's the funny thing. I'm very bad at writing criticism. I can't write a review of something. I suck at it. It was such a good review. And there were some lines in there, like, you know, what was laying stinking and unpublished at the bottom of my hot take hamper. I mean, just like hanging in the Louvre, like, that's awesome. I mean, you've already got the chops. It's just a matter of putting in the hours. And it's just really a matter of like how you want to do it. Like, you could do like I do and write 1,500 word essays and post them on Substack. You could write fiction, but the key is, writing is actually, it's worse than weightlifting, right? If you take a week off of lifting weights, your body actually heals and you get stronger, right? If you take a week off of writing, you get stupid, like, and it happens fast. That writing muscle atrophies so fast. So you really, really have to do it every day. So I do it even on the weekends. Saturday, Sunday, I'm sitting on the couch with the laptop and I'm writing stuff.
Well, I'm not going to turn this into a therapy session, but there's a lot of like insecurities that I have with writing, putting myself out there. What I'm getting at is like some of the stuff that you say, I can imagine it rankles a lot of people. My question is like, have you done that from day one? Did it take a lot of time for you to, you know, ease into that and get comfortable with your style, with your voice and say, you know what, I'm just going to say what I want to say? Or was it something else? I don't know.
You know, what's funny is, you know, with all the evil of this world, which is the filthiest book ever written by a lot. And, you know, when I wrote it, I was like, people can handle this. Like, they've had sex before. They know what it's like. Like, they've done drugs. They've seen this before. Like, it's not going to be a big deal. And then I started getting a bunch of 1-star reviews on Amazon and people were like, I threw it in the trash. I had like clients say this to me. They're like, I threw it away because I didn't want my kids to find it, you know? And I'm like, oh my God. But then I was like, well, that's good writing. Good writing makes you feel something, whether it's happy or sad, or in this case, revulsion. Good writing makes you feel something and provokes you. I read an incredible short story a couple of weeks ago about a fictitious game show. And it had an incredible twist of an ending, but basically it's kind of like one of these trivia game shows. But if you get the last question wrong, they actually get out an axe and chop off the contestant's head. That's like the reveal at the end of the story. And I read that. I'm like, they're bringing out the axe. I'm like, wait a minute. Like, is this happening? Like, what is going on? And it was one of the coolest endings to a story I ever wrote. And I talked to the guy that that put the anthology together, he's like, yeah, we almost didn't include it. And I'm like, God, that's the good stuff. That's the really good stuff. So,
yeah. In one of your, I think it was a recent newsletter, and I'm going to read it from here. You said your real goal was to, quote, revolutionize literary fiction. What does that mean exactly?
Well, you know, I'm kind of a throwback to the 90s. You know, I grew up on 90s literary fiction. I don't know your political orientation. I don't mean to just start a discussion on politics, but basically the literary world has gotten very woke. Okay. And the feeling in the literary world is that in the past, white male writers were overrepresented, which was probably true, right? And there was a backlash to that. And now white male writers are vastly underrepresented. I mean, to the point where they're almost non-existent. And now there's kind of a backlash to the backlash. There was an article written in the Free Press by a guy named Alex Perez, who went to the Iowa Writers Workshop. And he's kind of talking about this backlash to the backlash. And there's some indie presses that are springing up to publish these voices that aren't being heard anymore. I started off by saying I'm kind of a throwback to the 90s. I write really plot heavy stories with a lot of dialogue and a real focus on storytelling. And if you read the literary magazines nowadays, it's really, there's no plot, there's no story. It's just very experiential. And I'm like, who the hell reads this stuff? Like, I don't understand it. So what I'm trying to do is basically bring back the 90s, which I think was kind of the golden age. And, you know, what I'd really like is for this book to catch fire and for people to say, gosh, like, this is really, really good. Like, we need to be reading more of this stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, even just the term literary fiction, like, to me, and I'm no expert, but that essentially means kind of that character-driven lack of any kind of a plot versus Michael Crichton or James Patterson, whatever you want to call that type of fiction. Is that delineation, is that wrong? Or
no, I think you're hitting at it. Some people look at my writing and say, well, it's not literary. I'm like, okay, I guess. But I tell you what, people like reading my shit a lot more than they like reading your shit. So people love the stories.
I've been going down through the list of Pulitzer Prize winners for fiction. And I equate it to like watching all of the Oscar winning movies. They're great films. They're technically perfect. And the acting is incredible. And the direction and the framing and all this stuff. But it's just not all that entertaining at the end of the day. And I want to be entertained. So while I appreciate the craft and I appreciate the technical expertise it takes to write a beautiful short story that's literary fiction, it's almost like, I don't really want to read this. I want to be entertained.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because sales of literary fiction are plummeting. And basically the only people reading this stuff nowadays are the people who are writing it.
It's a circle jerk.
Imagine a world where your financial future isn't just a series of guesses and hopeful projections, but a meticulously crafted strategy designed by experts who get it. That's Adda, a financial advisory that's more than just suits and numbers. It's about understanding that behind every portfolio is a person, a family, a dream. Adda doesn't just play the game, we redefine it. Personalized strategies? Check. A deep dive into your financial DNA? Absolutely. A partner who celebrates your wins and strategizes your next moves? Without question. We're not just in it for the fiscal year, we're in it for the long haul. So if you're tired of the one-size-fits-all approach, the impersonal advice, and the feeling that you're just another account number, it's time for a change. It's time for Adda, where wealth meets wisdom. Where plans turn into action, where your financial future isn't just secure, it's empowered. Visit addafinancial.com today, because your legacy deserves more than just guesswork.
By the way, All the Evil of This World was published in 2016, and I wrote most of it in 2012, which is kind of before we had like this cultural revolution. So I wouldn't be able to write that book nowadays. Which is too bad, because it's as raw and unfiltered as you can possibly get, you know?
Okay. So your most recent book, No Worries, came out, 6 weeks ago, late January, right?
Yep.
Why'd you write it? Like, who's it for?
This is the first book I've written where You know, when I wrote Street Freak and it was being edited by the publisher, like I was really an asshole about it. I was like, look, this is my life. This is my story. And I don't want you screwing with it. And I kind of felt the same thing about All the Evil of This World, because that was really my big idea for a novel. No Worries is, it's really a commercial book. I have two goals. Number one is I've been very successful from a personal finance standpoint, and I've learned a lot, and I want to help other people. So I do have an altruistic goal, but also I want to make money. And this has been my most successful book so far. I thought it had the potential to sell hundreds of thousands or a million copies, and it still might. So I have really high hopes for that book, but I wasn't an asshole about the editing process. I'm like, whatever you guys want to do with it is really fine.
Well, look, I'm a financial advisor, but I do things differently. And one of the things is this idea that I wholeheartedly agree with you, is that you can measure your wealth by how much stress is, you know, around your money situation. So I tell people that I talk to all the time, like, I don't care about, you know, optimizing your risk adjusted return, so to speak. I care about maximizing your peace of mind, which is effectively, you know, the theme of No Worries. One of the things that I personally struggle with, and a lot of my clients do as well, is being a CF, a cheap fuck. I can be a cheap bastard in a lot of ways. You've talked about, you used to be a CF, but at some point you kind of graduated out of that mindset. So like, what happened?
It was about 2012, and I had been doing my newsletter for about 3 years, 4 years. And it was starting to seem like it was a sustainable business. And I wasn't making the kind of money I was making at Lehman yet, but I was still making good money. And I'm like, I can spend money on stuff. It's really fine. If I want to splurge and buy a $300 pair of jeans, I can do that. You know, I have the ability to do that. I guess I was about 38 or 39 at the time, and I started getting really focused on clothes, you know, focusing on my appearance, which is something I hadn't done before. When I was at Lehman, I used to wear like the cheapest suits of all time. And I would wear them forever, and I would get holes in the ass, and I would put like patches on the ass. I mean, I really look like, you know, at this bank, I look like I was homeless. But I started paying more attention to my appearance. I started spending money on clothes, and I still do that to this day. Like that's my thing.
Guilty pleasure.
Yep.
Was that kind of the, you know, the gateway drug to starting to spend a bit more freely for you?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
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 Okay. What would you say is the dumbest thing you've ever done with your money?
The dumbest thing I ever did with my money was I bought a motorcycle. It wasn't a motorcycle. It was one of those Can-Ams, one of those three-wheelers. Okay. Yeah. This is actually an interesting story. So Street Freak came out in 2011, and I got all this publicity, and there was all this excitement, and then the excitement kind of died down, and I got really depressed. And it wasn't like clinical depression. It was like existential depression. I was like, I am never going to accomplish anything like this again in my entire life. This was the top. It is all downhill from here. And this sucks. That was my thinking. So I know how dangerous motorcycles are. I know the statistics. And I was like, I do not care if I get run over on the highway. I am going to buy a motorcycle. So I went to the dealership, and I bought this Can-Am sport bike for like $19,000. And I used to ride it to work. I rode it all over the place. And there was one situation in particular where I was riding it down the highway, and there was literally an accident right in front of me. And if I had just been 2 seconds down the road, I would have died. Like, it was that close. And I said, that's it. I'm not riding this anymore. And I sold it for $3,000. So I took a $16,000 hit on the motorcycle, and I had it for a couple of years, but I think I just kind of had to go through that phase of my life. But in terms of like wasting money, like, it was stupid. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My dumbest thing is similar, but I was curious, when did you start writing in earnest? What year?
I did some writing in high school and college. I won some awards and stuff, and I was known as a good writer, but I didn't really start doing it a lot until 2004.
So throughout, you know, the early 2000s, when you were, you know, just starting at Lehman, were you taking notes like Michael Lewis style, or was it all just from memory when you put it down a few years later?
It was all just from memory. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what made you start writing? You had the successful career on Wall Street. You have your dream job. What made you do it?
Well, what happened was around 2004, I was put in charge of the ETF desk. And my boss at the time took me aside and he said to me, he's like, your job is not to trade ETFs. Your job is to market the business. I was like, well, what does that mean? Do I take out billboards or TV commercials? Like, how do you market an ETF business? But my idea was that I would write market commentary and get people interested in the business. So I started this Bloomberg email list. And over the next 4 years, I had thousands of people on that list. Like everybody wanted to get on that list and get my stuff. And to put that in perspective, how successful that was, when I took over, it was a $22 million business. In 2008, it was a $90 million business. It was hugely successful. And that's when I got the idea that I could start the Daily Dirt Nap and do the newsletter.
That was all, fairly cut and dry market commentary, right?
Well, I wouldn't call it cut and dry market commentary. I mean, a lot of it was, just me being me and,
Okay.
just a lot of screwing around and humor and great writing. And, it was probably like 40% market commentary and 60% just screwing around. So.
Okay. So, I'm in the business of acquiring clients. Some significant part of my day has to be business development. And part of that is writing, obviously. And I just feel like you got to have some sort of a voice, right? You can't just write the same crap that everybody else is writing. So this idea of kind of putting yourself out there, being a bit unique, saying things that might raise some hackles, I just have to think that's kind of like the way to go. And it sounds like that's what you were doing back in 2004.
Yeah,
Were
yeah,
you,
yeah.
do you think you were like ahead of the game, or
No,
were
I was
you?
definitely ahead of the game. I was definitely ahead of the game. You mentioned voice. I have a very strong first person nonfiction voice. That's really my greatest asset. I had a writing professor once tell me that anything in writing can be taught except for voice and imagination. The problem is that writing is like 90% voice and imagination. You know what I mean? Like that's really what it is. And the way I define voice is your brain is a filter. And some of us have very good filters, which means what's coming from your soul is not getting down to the keyboard. It's being filtered someplace in between. And I don't have much of a filter. It's coming straight from the heart onto the keyboard. And that's really what people like about it. You know what I mean? A book that has a very strong voice is the David Goggins book, Can't Hurt Me, right? The Navy SEAL book. Have you read that?
No, not yet.
All right. It's on the bestseller list. It sold millions of copies. It's basically Navy SEAL. It's his story about how he used to be like this punk piece of shit kid and how he became a Navy SEAL and now he runs triathlons and stuff like that. But it's an amazing book. He's an imbecile. He's a complete imbecile. Like he's a knucklehead. But he has this voice, which is so strong. And whoever, I don't remember who published the book, but whoever edited this guy, like they left the voice intact. And they left pretty much anything intact. Like, I mean, it's terrible writing, but that voice is there. And that's why that book has been so successful.
Yeah, I haven't read the book, but I've heard him on a few podcasts, so I can imagine if it is as I'm tilted, as you say, I can imagine what the book is like. But I'll have to check it out.
I mean, I didn't finish it. It's not that good. But I guess what I'm saying is I can see why people like it.
Because it has the voice.
Yeah.
Who do you think has like a distinctive voice from writers these days, whether fiction or nonfiction, finance or generally?
I mean, Michael Lewis does for sure. He's got a great nonfiction voice. I'm not a big Michael Lewis fan. There's some people that just like worship the guy and like I don't.
What about Matt Levine?
Yeah, Matt Levine has a very distinctive voice and it's so funny because I read his stuff and, unlike a lot of people, like actually know about the things that he's talking about. And I'm like, I could have said that, but I didn't. You know what I mean? Like, I know what he's talking about. Like, I had the ability to explain it in that way, but I didn't. And he did a better job. It's actually frustrating for me to read Matt Levine. He's so good at what he does.
I totally agree. Sometimes he'll dip into my old world of institutional lending, like subscription finance deals. He'll touch on those every once in a while. And I'm like, damn, like he's just so good at explaining any number of topics within finance and even outside. All right, so you got this talent, right? You're writing in high school, you're writing in college, you go to the military, you get a job on Wall Street, you write the memoir, you publish the novel, you write, I think, at least one more book, and then you enroll in an MFA program for writing. Why? Why? I don't mean to be facetious, but like, why waste your time?
It was funny when I was accepted to the school, one of the professors got me in a Zoom call and asked me the same question. He's like, "Why are you doing this?" So I explained to him, when I graduated from the Coast Guard Academy in 1996, I moved to Port Angeles, Washington, and there was a bookstore in town. They had a bunch of literary magazines there, and I would get the literary magazines and I would read all this stuff. And I was writing short stories at the time, and they weren't very good. I was very young. I was like 22. But I said, "This is what I want to do. I want to get out of the Coast Guard and I want to be a writer." So I called up my mom and I said, "Hey, mom, this is my plan." And I told her the plan. And she said, "That is a stupid idea. That is a terrible idea." She's like, "You're going to be poor. You need to make some money first." Well, I also had an interest in finance. So I applied to business school, got into business school, and I went that route instead. But I was always kind of upset with my mom because that was my dream, and she like shit all over my dream. And it was like the path not taken, which is actually one of my essays in Those Bastards, is the path not taken. It's like, what if I had done this instead? So it was during the pandemic, I think. It's 2020. My wife and I went camping in the middle of the summer. Huge mistake. It was just disgustingly hot. And I got into the tent and it was like an oven. I couldn't sleep. So I said, I'm gonna just sit by the fire. So I got up and I sat in a chair by the fire all night from like 10 o'clock at night till 6 in the morning. And I was just thinking about shit. And I said, what if I went and got my MFA, just like I said I was gonna do when I was 22? What if I did that? So the next morning, she gets out of the tent and I'm like, I know what I'm going to do. So I went back to the house and I started researching MFA programs. And at this point, I mean, I would love to go to Iowa, but I can't take 2 years off my business and, go to school. So I needed to find an online program, and SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design, had an online program. And they're also reasonably close by. So I decided to do that. So I applied and I got accepted. And my writing actually got a lot better during that program. It was totally worth it. And also, I got two books out of it. Those Bastards was from a class project. I had a digital communications class where you had to start a blog, and the book came out of that blog. And No Worries was actually my thesis. So I wrote the book as a thesis, and then I sold the book. And by the time I went and defended the thesis, I had a book deal. So picture this, like you're in an MFA program and this is your final thesis and you're defending it and you already have a book deal. Like that never happens. So it was really one of the smartest things I ever did in my life.
And you said it made you a better writer, but you had published, in my opinion, two incredible books. So what did it do exactly?
It's kind of hard to explain, but getting back to what we started talking about, a lot of it was just doing the reps. Like it was forcing me to write all the time, which just doing that made me better. But I was also like, I was kind of like an athlete. I was kind of like a natural athlete that had never been taught the theory or fundamentals behind what I was doing. So one of the reasons I went back to school was to learn the theory and fundamentals and the craft.
That's really interesting. So what's the dream? Like, what is everything you're spending your time on is something that you love doing. What does that look like? And what goals have you hit at that point in like the next 3 to 5 years?
I don't know. I can't think that far ahead. Really, I'm still marketing No Worries. I'm really focused on the short story collection. I want that to be a big success. If it is a success, maybe that leads to other opportunities. Like, I kind of have this theory about writing in general. Like, if you're writing and putting stuff out there, you're basically buying a bunch of free optionality. Like, out of all the essays I've ever written, there are so many good things that have come out of it. Opportunities, but also connections with people and stuff like that. I was at a conference in LA about 6 months ago, and this guy comes up to me and he tells me that my writing on suicide and bipolar disorder saved his life. Like, literally saved his life. He was suicidal and it saved his life. So I just keep putting stuff out there and it just leads to more and more good things. And I have this theory about how luck will never find you in your apartment. Like, I'm still in my house writing this stuff, but nothing good is going to happen to me if I keep it all in. Like, I have to get it out, and it just leads to more and more opportunities.
Well, look, man, I'm not blowing smoke, but I'm one of those people. I mean, you've had an impact on me. I've learned a lot of lessons from you and your writing. And I mean, this podcast right here is just goes to show that you put yourself out there. And what was the line again? You're not gonna.
Luck will never find you in your apartment.
That's incredible. I wholeheartedly believe in that, but I just have these insecurities when it comes to telling my story, whether it's like, any number of embarrassments or regrets or shameful things or failures that I've had in my life and my career, et cetera, et cetera. Does that ever stop? Are you just used to it, or how does that manifest itself in your brain?
So, first of all, one of the reasons I write, actually, the main reason I write, I don't really write for other people. I write for me because it's therapeutic. Like, just the act of writing it down and sending it out, it helps me out. Like, I don't really set out to help other people, but it really helps me. I can tell you that, I can hear in your voice that you have a lot of stories that you want to tell and you're worried about how they'll be received and stuff like that. A lot of people say to me, well, I would write a book, but I have a very boring life. I'm like, nobody has a boring life. Everybody has a story. Everybody has a story. It's just a matter of the storytelling. Like, if you gave me the story of somebody who worked for a public utility in Norwich, Connecticut, who went home every day and watched American Idol, like, I could turn that into a story. You know what I mean? Like, everybody has a story. It's just a matter of the storyteller, like, telling the story. Everybody is interesting.
Honestly, what it probably is, and I haven't thought about this too much, it's having like friends and family read it. I don't care if strangers read it. It's my friends and family. That's what holds me back. Me writing some stuff, putting it online, me doing this podcast. I mean, this is not my comfort zone, man. But I think every time I do it, it gets a bit more comfortable. And like you said, the idea is just to make connections, put some stuff out there and see what happens. But this is not easy for me. You mentioned American Idol. I'm a big fan. You talk about telling a story, man. They are masters of that. I probably cried more during an American Idol auditions than, any other media put together. Like, seriously.
Tongi from last year. That was incredible.
That was beautiful. I mean, they're just getting better at it. Let me go back to No Worries real quick. Like I said, I haven't had a chance to finish it. I'm halfway through. It's similar to Those Bastards where I'm highlighting like constantly. This is a book that I see myself buying copies of and giving out to my clients because that's what it's about. Not thinking about your money, not having to worry about it. That's the whole idea. That's why we're doing this. Money is just a tool. Money is a mindset, and we don't want it to bring negative emotions into our lives. Like that's my whole thing. So thank you. Thank you for writing, man.
It's a great book. It's a great book. I think the sequel is going to be The Awesome Portfolio.
So let me see if I can remember what the awesome portfolio is. A quarter gold, a quarter stock.
20% stocks, 20% bonds, gold, cash, and real estate.
The biggest thing that I have a question on in that portfolio is bonds. I can't wrap my head around why right now, when interest rates are fairly high, you can get 5% on cash. What purpose do bonds have in, an average 40-year-old's portfolio?
I
This is
mean,
a genuine question that I have.
it may seem that, with deficits being what they are, just this unlimited supply of treasuries and inflation, like, it might seem like bonds may not make a lot of sense. But if we have a recession, you're going to have a 200 basis point move in tens. The ag is going to return like 15% a year. It just, you can't. A lot of people say, like, well, you should underweight bonds in the portfolio. I'm like, no, you keep them in the proper allocations because you just don't know what is going to happen. You can't predict,
So do you think of it as just a hedge then?
No, I mean, really, all the asset classes are in there for a reason because of the correlations with each other. So stocks and bonds are usually negatively correlated. They were positively correlated for the last couple of years. They could be negatively correlated again. But then you have gold, which is not really correlated to anything, and real estate, which is slightly correlated to stocks, but is more correlated to inflation. Like, all the asset classes are in there for a reason. Like, you don't say, well, I don't want this asset class because it returns less than everything else. It's in there for its contribution to portfolio risk, right? That's why it works. So,
where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Daily Dirt Nap. The Daily Dirt Nap newsletter is at dailydirtnap.com. My personal finance business is jareddillionmoney.com. And all the books are on Amazon. So Street Freak, All the Evil of This World, Those Bastards, No Worries. And like I said, there's going to be a new book in November. So
obviously I love your nonfiction, but I'm really excited.
You're going to love it.
I can't wait. But listen, this was fantastic. Thanks again. Great meeting you.
Thanks.